enjoy you from the chemical comfort of America.
Hello, everybody. This is Eric Mack again with Liberally Correct. I almost forgot the name of our podcast because it has been so long since we have recorded an episode. It's been more than a month. So, Brett Madsen, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Did you disappear from the earth like I did?
No, I did not disappear from the earth because I did not start a new job. So, congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. My job is actually on one of those planets they discovered. That's like only 40 light years away. So my commute's not so bad. So I've been checking out those new worlds, and James Cameron has a trilogy based on each one of those planets.
As long as there are eerie blue people on it. I want it to be upsetting.
I was watching the Oscars the other night, and saw a commercial for, I'd totally forgotten about this, but I saw a commercial for that they're opening like Avatar Land or something at Disney World.
And, yeah, that would make sense.
Where it's either Disney World or Universal or maybe it's its own thing. I don't know. I don't really care.
It's its own theme park.
Yeah.
So good. I'm glad we talked about that for a while.
Yes.
What's the topic of tonight's Liberally Correct?
I think... I should have gone back and checked, but like we initially set out to do this like saga on the media, and I think we started that like back in December. I think
we did. We did shortly after the election.
Yeah, and we got kind of derailed a little bit. We had a guest on in our previous episode, and now we're finally getting to it. So we did a couple episodes on just social media and online media. And then we did another episode on TV news and TV media. And now finally going to close this great and epic saga that beats anything James Cameron's ever done. By bringing the climax to print media.
I thought you were going to say by bringing the climax to the climax. I thought you'd gotten yourself into that little linguistic corner, but you got out okay. It was just in my head.
Well, this is so much better than this is even better than the what was it, like the steel factory or the steel mill or whatever at the end of Terminator 2.
I don't know what is better than the end of Terminator 2.
That
I mean that in life generally, but I don't know what you're talking about right now.
Yeah. That's where this podcast is right now. We're in that scene with a frozen liquid metal Terminator getting shot up and then forming back together. Yeah.
Is the liquid metal Terminator Donald Trump? Is that what we're getting at here?
Possibly. Or it's Putin. I don't know.
I think the liquid metal Terminator is Mitch McConnell.
Oh, gosh.
It can't be killed. It can't be stopped. It never speaks above.
He's too reptilian to be... He has to be like a Pandora native. He's got to be on Pandora.
This is just an advertisement for James Cameron so far.
Yeah. So let's get into print. We've kind of... In talking about social media and broadcast media, we kind of talked about print as well. It's kind of impossible not to. There's the barriers have kind of been eliminated between all these different types of media now. So maybe let's start with you and I. I think we both mentioned in previous episodes that we both grew up, you know, having a newspaper delivered to our houses. Right.
Oh yeah, I loved it. I knew a local columnist.
For you, it was Miami Herald or Fort Lauderdale.
No, the South Florida Sun Sentinel.
Oh yes, I forgot about that one.
I actually worked for them in high school. It was fun. Well,
yeah, I'm sure you probably thought that was like some kind of prestigious gig to like work at a newspaper. Like, and now,
oh, it was fun, but I mean, we were high schoolers. I thought maybe working at a newspaper might be a prestigious gig, but in our department, it was just fun.
Yeah,
because you know we were children.
Nice. Okay, so growing up in Maryland, everybody either had the Baltimore Sun or the Washington Post. So you could kind of take your pick of the two. And I know my grandparents who live close by got the Baltimore Sun and we got the Washington Post. So, yeah, I would say the Washington Post was better. Still was better.
Glad that we cleared that up. Oh, I love that experience, actually. I always loved newspapers. I love actually spreading them all out. I would sometimes have like four different sections. Because I wanted my movie reviews, and when they had those, I was always excited on Friday. They had, like, the local critic, because this is the Boca Raton area that I'm growing up in. You had the local critic, like, buried amidst all these tales of, like, elderly Jews going out to eat, which was half of the weekend section. And the other half was mostly advertisements, and there would be, like, one movie review. And I was very excited about the movie review. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I liked the ritual. Of basically disassembling the thing.
Yeah, there was something satisfying about everything being contained like that.
Yeah,
that I really do miss. I mean, obviously having all this kind of instant access and notifications sent to your phone and stuff. Now that we have that, I wouldn't necessarily trade that. You know, case in point was when I got a notification from the Washington Post earlier about like this thing with Jeff Sessions with some Russian ties that he neglected to mention at his swearing in or whatever, or his, what do you call that?
Confirmation
hearings. There we go.
Yeah. Al Franken directly asked him if he had. Yeah. Al Franken in person, and I'm forgetting the other senator who asked him in text, and both times he said no. Specifically and directly. Yeah. Weird thing.
Yeah, with that kind of, obviously, the way podcasts work, not a great idea to sort of hash out some sort of current events kind of stuff, but that's just an example of, you know, it is like pretty cool to just get a notification like that on your phone, especially when it's something like that when you really want to see it.
Yeah, no, this is a useful example since we're talking about print media. There are many things that it can't do that the other forms of media can, or that it can only do by linking itself to these other forms. Like a lot of the news stories that you get from a reputable news source come through Facebook or some other conglomerate now. That's just the way it works. You're not going to them directly necessarily to find your news. It generates content and you're part of a content aggregator and you get the content. That's how this happens. At the same time, they're doing things that nobody else is doing. The Washington Post and the New York Times have been just relentless with the reporting on the White House since the inauguration, even leading up to the inauguration, and it's been wonderful. CNN is not dropping exclusives like that. The comedy shows, the left-leaning comics that I like so much, like Seth Meyers and John Oliver, they are just repeating or commenting on what happens in the news. They're not actually sending, you know, they're not actually meeting with anonymous sources somewhere in Washington, right? It's actually really these two newspapers are getting most of the material that we have on the new administration. So there are things they can't do. They can't reach you as directly as they used to unless you want to be reached or support their mission almost like a charity. Yet at the same time, they're doing work that no one else seems to be capable of doing. It's a strange dichotomy.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting you mentioned CNN because I think, you know, obviously it became a go-to play for Trump to just sort of label anything that he didn't like or doesn't like still as you're fake news. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. And I think the first time he did that was to a CNN reporter who was like sitting right in front of him and was kind of badgering him.
Yeah.
I think CNN was kind of the first.
Yeah. But obviously CNN,
others have been added to the pile.
Yeah, but my point there is for reasons that may have to do with the nature of being on CNN,
yeah,
having your face out in public, they're not, it's not that what they're reporting is incorrect or bad or that they're necessarily doing a bad job. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. It's that they're not doing the kind of in-depth, off-the-record investigations that the New York Times and the Post are doing right now with the administration.
Yeah, that is a good point because, yeah, due to the nature of TV is so public-facing and has a more interactive and, I don't know about participatory, but I mean, I kind of take that back because now they're constantly trying to get you to, you know, tweet hashtag this and then we'll read your comments on the show or, you know, that kind of bullshit where the anchors like respond to your tweets.
Hey, let's see. We've got a studio. We're paying this person $2 million to be on the air in the middle of a Tuesday. Okay, cool. Everything's good.
Let's have them answer tweets.
Yeah, let's read Twitter. Let's see what's happening.
Yes. But you're right though that due to the nature of like just the fact that newspapers even still to this day, even though now things are swinging massively toward digital, there's still a wall that they can kind of hide behind. Like reporters are essentially faceless when they're at newspapers.
Yeah, and this is the thing that's interesting to me is that there's no reason that shouldn't be possible with an online only publication. Right. In theory. All right. Well, we just instead of having a giant skyscraper, we don't have as connected offices. We don't have as big a budget for traditional overhead because we don't need that. We're just a website. We can do the same kind of reporting. And I think that will be what good news organizations of the future look like. And certainly there are some like that now. But for the most part, the ones who are really getting the good stuff, doing this solid reporting, are still coming from this kind of old world.
Yeah, there's
yet the old world is dying. So.
Even though there are still some, there are some online only, and that started as websites. There are some good publications like Politico. I think is one that I would consider to be reputable. Even though I don't really look at Politico all that much, The Daily Beast I think is I think they have some really good content over there in terms of writers and analysis. Like the editor in chief John Avlon, who's on CNN all the time, I think is and who actually wrote a book recently about George Washington's farewell address. Those are examples. So first of all, Daily Beast used to be, I think, associated with Newsweek, so maybe that's why it gets kind of a bump in perception. I don't know if they're associated with them anymore, but. But yeah, there are when it comes to those online only publications, they have to kind of beat this stigma of, hey, you started as an online only thing, and whenever you see somebody from an online only publication on TV, it always kind of seems like that they're there to get attention so that their publication can seem more legitimate. That their website can seem more legitimate. That's how it always comes across. And
yeah,
it's not the fact that somebody prints something on paper and delivers it as a product. I don't know if that necessarily means their reporters are any better or more honest but for some reason that's the perception.
Well, I don't know that it's for some reason. I think that perception is earned. And two, it's because that's where the infrastructure is.
That's true.
That's all the reporting that was. It's new. It's not new for... let me back up here. The internet is an extremely new thing in human history. So when I say it's new or it's old, I'm talking within this tiny, tiny era of history where we have the internet. So in the last 15 or so years, it's new for news organizations that are just based online to be good. That's pretty new. That's only been happening, 5, 6, 7 years, maybe half that time of this very small sliver of history.
Online only? No, they've had that.
No, online only sources being starting to hang with the big boys, hang with the print reporters. I mean, this is a qualitative statement.
I would say 10 years.
Okay.
I think the Huffington Post was like one of the first kind of news sites to really get traction like that.
But weren't they primarily at the outset like just content aggregators? Right? You didn't pay the whole controversy was people realized, oh my god, the internet just doesn't pay people. reduces the value of creation.
No, they did that to some extent. That was part of how they generated content to begin with. But they also, I mean, due to the, like, they had, like, a really good infrastructure of just, it was more of just kind of a networking thing where they just, they had access to a whole bunch of celebrities and high profile people who would write for the site, and that would get them eyeballs. And then if you have enough eyeballs, then you can, and you know, you're making enough money, and then you can actually pay people to be reporters. So
it comes around slowly.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's a good strategy, and Arianna Huffington eventually cashed out and sold to AOL.
Oh, that's one of those companies I forget still exists.
Yeah.
It was a few years back, but I remember reading something about how Yahoo is still worth like a pretty big chunk of money, just kind of because it was around at the right time.
Yeah, I was wondering that too, because I saw that like Verizon was gonna like buy him out for like $4 billion or something, and I was like, well, what does Yahoo do that's worth $4 billion?
Yeah, you're like, all right, they must have an office building somewhere. They probably got like a lot of servers, maybe a few contracts of some of the engineers or whatever.
The reality of it is they have a huge database of users, probably mostly inactive, but throughout Yahoo's entire history, 20 plus years now, that if they sell to Verizon, Verizon will just tap into that giant. They're basically just buying leads so they can sell Verizon stuff.
Jesus Christ.
That would be probably my take on it.
I can't,
because what else? What's Verizon gonna do? What's Verizon gonna do with Yahoo? And like, it's like, whoa, you can play, card games and stuff on Yahoo.
Hey, don't knock it. Could you imagine being able to do that?
That was a big thing back in the day. I really was. I was into that.
Oh yeah.
Yes. The internet was not as fun back then.
Yeah, there wasn't as much to do. Life didn't have as much stuff in it. Or had the same amount of stuff, but you were less aware of it. But yeah, like, so even there, you're talking about how the Huffington Post started. You can kind of see this. See, God damn it, I should have done more research before we just started talking here. But I think you're starting to see, occasionally, you're finding hard news outlets that are started online for the purpose of hard news. But I think that's quite recent. Otherwise, you're finding outlets like fucking BuzzFeed has reporters now. Which is still weird to me. I'm an old enough man that I'm still a little frightened by that. I'm like, isn't that just 39 weird foods that look kind of like your boyfriend's penis?
Right.
Isn't that the whole
listicles? Yeah.
Right. And now suddenly it's a thing. Now they have reporters, and they've got a guy who has a White House credential. Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know that he had one to be revoked.
Yeah, I mean, this is something
I'm learning new things every day.
This is more of like a generational thing that I don't think that would horrify those who have come before us. And I think I think it would horrify you more than it does me. I've just sort of accepted the reality of it, which is that, you know, it's almost comical when you look back at like our schooling and stuff about how like there was this like fear of God about plagiarizing and all that kind of stuff. Like, oh, plagiarize once and you're out, you know. Plagiarism is like the death knell or whatever, you know. Grim Reaper will come after you if you plagiarize. And then you get out into the internet where there are essentially no rules. So like these sites like BuzzFeed, a lot of these viral sites that basically just, you know, like you were saying, aggregate others' content that basically they don't even come up with, and then they're so good at promoting it that they can get it to go viral and then drive a bunch of page views and collect ad money for stuff that they don't even come up with.
Oh, my favorite in this genre, I gotta say, as an old man, let me pause here. The one that blows my mind still is this subgenre where the headline says, celebrity does something funny in video. You click on it, and it's like 500 words telling you, all right, hold on to your butts. There's a video. There's a celebrity in it. They say something that's popular with the politics, that squares with the politics of most college students right now. And then they go on to describe the video almost frame by frame. It blows my mind every time I see one of those. Later in the video, someone will be like, "What? Why is this here?" But it, I guess page views. I guess it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally kind of offensive to, I think, educated people's sensibilities that, like, you know, you spend your entire life going through school and, like, kind of thinking, like, oh, no, you have to put together this, like, really well-written thing in order for it to do well or whatever. It's like, really, that's actually kind of not the case anymore. And it's sad. That's what it really is.
It's quite sad because it's easier than ever to communicate. And the informal rules of communication are breaking down. So you have more people spewing more nonsense at each other without ever articulating the vague things that they mean to say. It's confusing. When there used to be rules that informal rules even that were enforced, and there used to be typewriters, so there actually was sort of a skill gap between what you thought. There was like a space. There are walls between you thinking the thing, you getting it to somebody else. People who couldn't communicate well couldn't do it as much.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be gatekeepers too, but
yeah,
now it sort of doesn't matter. If you can put together a website and get more traffic than these sort of quote-unquote prestigious institutions, then, you know, I guess, feel proud of yourself, but you're not contributing anything other than, but I guess you're making a nice living. Like, the latest variation on that theme is the fake news, actual fake news, not Trump's fake news.
Yeah. So getting back though to print and all of this, it's clear that the model is dying. Like the idea, it's been.
Well,
yeah, I'm surprised it's not really
the model isn't dying because it's actually the same, right? It's still subscriptions and advertising, right? It's like that's still the model, but they've just kind of moved. It's like a restaurant in a new location or something, you know. It's like they've moved from the newspaper to on the internet.
But it's not replacing everything that they were getting, is the danger.
That's true.
Because you have, I mean, you know, well, we're not in journalism. People have been wringing their hands about this for a while.
Continue the analogy. I mean, it's like they moved into a taller building that can fit more restaurants inside or something. Like, I don't know, but it's like there's just the thing is like there's just the volume of competition is huge.
Well, there used to be that volume of competition. It was just split by geography. So you used to, the New York Times would compete with probably just as many news outlets, just they were all, those news outlets did not also compete with each other, right? Like the Bumblefuck Morning Gazette wasn't available to everyone in the world with a computer.
True, but then it's not competing with the New York Times.
In Bumblefuck it is.
I don't know. Was the New York Times, does that get delivered nationwide?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, right? Well, I mean, certainly it still does now. But yeah, they had.
Okay.
Yeah, it was delivered nationwide. I suppose. Yeah, maybe it was only like in major cities though. Yeah. So you're right. Maybe it didn't get delivered to Bumblefuck. Huh. Oh well. So much for that. So yeah, I guess the separation by region, the physical act of getting a newspaper to somewhere else. Stopped all these different news organizations from directly competing with each other, which is interesting.
Yeah, I still sort of think it's kind of the opposite, where since there was the geographical separation, I mean, it's like, so in where, I mean, where I grew up, I mean, like you couldn't get the New York Times. I mean, like, I don't know, maybe in the city, maybe if you went to Baltimore or into DC, you could, but it was like, even if you went to the 7-Eleven, the New York Times was not there.
Huh, because when I was growing up, it was, for the most part.
Well, it's because of New York transplants.
Yep, Boca Raton, Florida. Yeah, I guess if you had enough of a population that asked for it. Yeah, okay, so there just wasn't, there wasn't as much competition. Everybody was just You were limited how far you could reach.
Okay, well let's just take me for an example. So in Annapolis, Maryland, you could get the Washington Post, Washington Times, I guess, which nobody got, Baltimore Sun, and there was a local paper called the Capital, which was like a Anne Arundel County, just kind of a local Annapolis paper, and that was it in terms of I don't think even the Wall Street Journal or USA Today, nobody was getting that either. So that was pretty much it. It was like you had your pick of, it was kind of the, almost like the, you had two major networks and one PBS channel or something like that. That would be sort of the equivalent. It was like at the time, TV had moved into the cable age, but newspaper wise, it was still in the 1950s or 60s broadcast TV age.
Well, this is interesting to go back and think about it that way, because the narrative you get is newspapers are dying, right? Full stop. Yeah. Newspapers are dying. What shall we do? Can they move online fast enough to stave off the onslaught? Which I've got to say, I've been surprised that they've lasted as long as they have. Like the fact that the New York Times is still a thing, is still an organization, surprises me. I would have thought 5 years ago that was about it.
But they got ahead of the curve and built a good subscriber based business model.
Before
everyone else did.
Yeah, but that's sort of, so that's obviously a great business decision, but that sort of plays into what I'm thinking here next. So the thing that everyone says is the internet came and the newspapers left. But it's not quite true. It's more like the internet came and now you could get the best newspaper.
Yeah,
so the first thing that happened is the New York Times gobbled up all the other newspapers.
It just commoditized the newspaper business. So, the example for that was like I had a college professor who toward the end of spring semester of my senior year sort of gave us all advice on how we should like put stuff on our resumes. And he said, like, unless you have a 4.0, don't put your GPA on your resume. And because otherwise that just commoditizes yourself. Because then they look at that and they say, well, why don't we just go hire somebody who has a 4.0, right? And it's like, so now that everybody has access to the internet and everybody can go read the New York Times, it's like, why would I, even if I'm in Wyoming, why would I read a local Wyoming newspaper if I could go read the New York Times? Right? It's like, it's just
because you live in Wyoming and you don't like those fucking New Yorkers.
Yeah, that's true. But there's enough people who, I guess, are sympathetic to the New York Times that I'm sure some people in Wyoming must read it online.
Yeah, no, that'll happen. So we're kind of getting a little far afield here.
Well, this leads into one thing that I wanted to actually bring up the next time when we actually had this podcast, which is something I texted to you about 10 days ago. I was watching Reliable Sources on CNN, which is again a great show. Everybody watch Reliable Sources. Because it's about how the news gets made and how the media covers things. And somebody, this lady, I forget who, made this great point that, you know, this distrust of the media basically has developed ever since these kind of small town newspapers and local newspapers kind of folded up. And because now the media has much less of a presence, like, in the communities across America. It's like, you know, that paper I mentioned called The Capital, which is still active in Annapolis, Maryland, like most people either got The Capital or were aware of it and what was in it. And they knew that they could always, you know, go to the newsstand and buy a copy if they wanted to read something specific about, because it was all just reporting about local stuff, like in the Annapolis area. So the fact that you were sort of plugged into that did kind of hold the community together more. And the thing that you have now is like everybody's on Facebook and YouTube and, you know, it's definitely not the same anymore. And one of the things that I sort of wondered, and I put this to you in the text as well, I said, like, you know what, I'm willing to bet that if they surveyed or polled people in those places where they say that they hate the media, and they say, okay, do you hate the national CBS news? Like, yes or no? Like this national CBS evening news broadcast or whatever. And they'll probably say, yes, I hate them. It's like, okay, but your local CBS station, do you hate that news? Like, I'm willing to bet that the answer to that would probably be no.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time. Yeah, local anchors still have appeal.
Yeah, because it's like,
yeah, there's,
because they, it's like they're actually doing this for me. It's like they're reporting all this to, it's like it just, it has this kind of local function that I think really appeals to people. And like this, everybody, they keep referring to Washington as like this nebulous, like, oh my God, even Obama was talking about this, like when in the campaign run up in 2008, when he was saying like, well, we need to go in there and change Washington. Like,
yeah. Almost everyone can agree in concept that we need to change Washington.
Yeah.
Because the government is vaguely corrupt somehow all the time, and you can't trust anything they say.
Yeah.
But you wish it was better.
Yeah. That was pretty much the end of my point. So,
well, it's look at us. Look at what we're doing. We're technically on the internet aggregating something. We're basing our analysis. We didn't make that point. Somebody on this TV show made the point, and now we're talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's a good observation. And when we're just talking about how the New York Times didn't face the pressures from the internet the same way that your local newspaper did, because the first thing that happened was the New York Times got an edge over your local newspaper, that also siphoned the talent line. So it made, there has been for decades, I'm sure, a reporting class, you know, people who are pretty cozy with certain politicians, can always go to some first source, know the press secretaries, have known different presidents, ask them questions. But now you get such a concentration at the few remaining print giants, and even those new organizations that function like the print giants, like Politico, tend to be based in these big urban centers and near centers of power. You have this reporting class that is very different from, like these people probably aren't your neighbors, right? it's a different world now. Now you're reading from people who are potentially very unlike you, reporting even if you do live in New York or if you do live in Washington D.C. It's a small cadre of very dedicated people. So this idea that the media, it's fun to mock the idea that the media is out to get the Republicans, or the media is this, or the media is that. And it's very unspecific, and it can be damaging to just throw out bland and bold generalizations that turn into conspiracy theories. But there's a lot of truth to that idea. Like, if you're that person in Wyoming, right, and you don't like the New York Times, and you say that they don't respect my values, they really don't. They don't. No. Probably care that. They care about how the games are being played. They care about what the reporter next to them is doing. They care about what the story of the day is, because their club has agreed on what the story of the day is. So there's, I don't know if I have a conclusion.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, their club has decided what the news of the day is. Yeah, that is an interesting way to put it, because that is how
they live in two cities. The club lives in two cities with a few outliers in L.A.
Yeah,
And a few scattered throughout the country and big cities. But yeah, it is a club.
Yeah, and like the thing that the people who sort of feel that way don't seem to understand is that, like, okay, even if they sent, you know, quote unquote, their people to do that job, this is something Fox News doesn't seem to get either. Like, I'm not sure they would go there and report what happens as anything different, right? I mean, it's like, they'd still go there, and like, if they go to, like, if they're, say, you know, White House correspondent and they cover a press conference, it would be like part of the tape they would make of the day's events or whatever. I mean, it would like, it's not that different, right? If you're just, if you're making it the sort of recap presentation of what happened that day, it's the only thing that's where things get different is when you have people like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity doing their sort of pundit shows. I mean, even I was heartened the other day when Bret Baier actually stood up for all those publications that got kicked out of that gaggle or whatever last week.
Yeah, Chris Wallace did too, as I heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good on them. I'm surprised he did. Yeah. So you're saying you think the club is not dangerous. But I think there's kind of a point to that sort of mistrust of having...
I'm saying that it's not dangerous. I mean, it's not dangerous in the sense that
you're saying it's not just because it is a club doesn't mean it's necessarily a nefarious organization or loose
control. Right. Yeah. In that sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that I agree. Yeah. That I definitely.
But
agree.
Yeah, the idea, I do agree with you. That
just because they're elite class, everyone in it is bad is silly. But yeah, it is because the club then decides what the news of the day is, and it's always about the same few things.
Yeah.
That relate to those people who live in mostly those two cities.
And yeah, if the thing that you know, people in the real America, I guess, don't seem to comprehend is that, yeah, I mean, like I said a few minutes ago, you know, if they were to sort of set up this kind of system for reporting, for covering the White House and reporting what happens and stuff like it, just it, like, I don't think it would be all that different. The only, I mean, where you do see that it is different is like these conspiracy sites, you know, like InfoWars or Breitbart actually does have a press credential, actually.
Well, now.
No, they. I think they have for a while.
Actually. Really, they have. It's been the Obama administration.
The White House Correspondents Association is like an independent thing. Wow. It doesn't have anything to do with who is president. So, even under Obama, they had.
Oh no, no, I knew that. I meant, I was surprised that they had one during his administration because I thought they would only be that would have only happened with sort of the I would have thought the White House.
Oh, just because they're kind of new. Yeah.
Yeah. They're new, and I thought they would have been sort of grudgingly handed one on the grounds that, well, these people do talk to you guys, so
yeah,
you should probably be part of this room, this gaggle. I'm pretty sure that's an incorrect use of the word gaggle. I'm not part of the club. So this is where I see an effect of the club. I see it in how do I say this? In two stories that have recently come out, where the club can be a good thing and the club can be a bad thing. So. This report that so far doesn't seem to be being picked up by other outlets is disappointing to me. This report about Sessions, pretty much straight up lying and about contacting Russians, is amazing reporting. The fact that someone was able to have multiple sources corroborate this story, have them willing to talk about it, I mean, even off the record, so early in this new administration, have this news come to light so quickly, is really impressive. There's also a companion story in the New York Times, well, I mean, not intended to be a companion story, but it functions as one, about how Obama administration aides spent about 2 months leaving breadcrumbs scattered throughout different agencies to make sure that the evidence wasn't destroyed for how much contact there had been between Trump aides and high-level Russian officials, which is six different kinds of terrifying and also weird. This is the sort of thing you can't get without these people, the reporters, I mean, knowing Washington really well, living there a long time, being part of the club, knowing each other, knowing officials at different government agencies, knowing what to say when, knowing what kind of question to ask. It's really remarkable, and it's something that we desperately need when we have a president, and more than the president, who's just a moron, a president's staff who's actively trying to destroy the free press. So it's remarkable. It's amazing. It's the kind of thing that this elite cadre of reporters can get you. At the same time, there are a million and one stories today about how, oh, President Trump's president now. because he sounded presidential. He gave this speech last night, his sort of sub-state of the union. I forget exactly what they call it, the one before you've been in office year. But, and they say, oh, my God, he didn't sound as loopy as normal, therefore he's now good. And this is the dark side of being part of the club. As soon as somebody does something that you like that conforms to your expectations, they're like, well, I'm used to covering these speeches, and this is how it usually happens.
Well, I would say that CNN last night was like Van Jones, who I'm usually a huge fan of. I love educated, well-spoken black men, just because.
That sounds like a fetish, but continue.
Yeah, well, frankly, there aren't enough of them on TV, I think. And I think he speaks well for his people. So I'd like to see.
I know you got that good in your heart, but for some reason, I was really terrified that you were just going to stop it. I thought I don't think there are enough of them. Yeah. Like, no, please keep going.
So yeah, I turn on CNN toward the end of the speech or whatever. It was right in the middle of that Navy SEAL thing. There's this huge standing ovation. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And then the analysis is like that they have on the panel. Or whatever. It's like Van Jones is like giving him like all these praises, like, oh, like after tonight or whatever, oh, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, like, can we? I mean, like, all he did was stand up there and read a teleprompter. And it's like, simply because he was able to do that, we're like suddenly saying that, like, he should be. I didn't see the whole thing, I didn't see much of it, but it's like somebody wrote a good speech and he gave it, and
which, by the way, was not that great of a speech. I did not see the entire thing, but just highlights excerpts in text and in video. It was, you know, cliches piled into each other that left a lot of wiggle room for him to still do terrible things. It basically made no sense, and half the time he would say things like, we've got to put behind us the stuff that some people do, and then go on to describe shit he does on the reg. The time for I wanted him to say Trivial Pursuits. He didn't say that, but like Trivial Fights, Trivial Disputes is behind us. I'm like, that's you, that's all you do, you're the Trivial Dispute. And sometimes not so trivial dispute, like the fact that you really, really want to make sweet bareback love to Vladimir Putin. that's a cool thing for the president to say repeatedly. I like that he gets angry when that happens too. Like, even Bill O'Reilly is like, maybe we shouldn't be friends with, you know, Stalin the second. And he's like, no, I really want to. And O'Reilly's kind of asking him, why? And he said, fuck you, I want to.
We've done horrible things too. Like,
oh, that was a miracle.
He added that for like pretty much no reason. But yeah,
you are the franchise. You can't throw that shit in there, even if it's true. Which of course it's true that the United States government has done shitty things. You can't say that when you're the face of the organization. That's horrible. Anyway, sorry, that was a tangent.
There's also this thing where he's saluting this fallen Navy SEAL. When it was him, when the SEAL basically died under like Trump's operation or whatever, or you know, it's like he's the commander in chief. He's got to sign the letter to the fallen, to the whatever, to the family. To his wife, or yeah, to the family.
Well, that one I'd give him a little more. Taking ownership, I can't believe I'm saying this about Trump. Yeah, what bothers me is that he wants to blame other people for the failure of the operation. But talking about the heroism of soldiers, even soldiers you have sent to harm's way, even soldiers who die because of missions that you ordered, that's a common thing for presidents to do. So I don't mind the concept. I mind the idea that he's blaming other people for it going wrong publicly. That's despicable for a commander-in-chief. Yeah, but let's see, what was I going to say here? Okay, so yeah, so those are the things I see. I see Van Jones is obviously on television news, but I saw the print media doing it. I see this club of people who can get this information and hold the administration accountable. Basically at these two organizations, with some assists from Politico, as you said, and a few others, but it really is. The New Yorker does some good work.
So That's one of the magazines I subscribe to. I should have said this at the top, but shout out to the New Yorker, which I think is great. I think their New Yorker Today app is great. I look at that every day on my phone. I subscribe to The Atlantic as well and The Economist. I love all three. So go ahead, New Yorker.
All right, yeah. But so the New Yorker's doing good work. I like The Atlantic, but it's, of course, more of a commentary thing. The New Yorker does some good reporting, but it's mostly The Times and The Post that are really getting in there, getting in the administration and getting after these guys. And at the same time, they gaze ever at the navel. You know? It's a contradiction. Maybe not even a contradiction. It's almost like you can't have this one good thing without these bad side effects. When President Trump was President-elect Trump, and he was, by the way, that's never going to sound normal to say, President Trump, President Celebrity Apprentice.
Yes.
President Celebrity Apprentice was the President-elect. He ditched his press pool a bunch of times in a row. And it seemed, at least to me, pretty clearly on purpose, and just because he was saying, fuck you guys. And the press threw a hissy fit over it. And I couldn't believe their outrage. He's breaking protocol, is what they said. If the argument is this guy is trying to immediately hide things from us, and it's dangerous because we're a country that's built on free speech and the free dissemination of information, and we want to know what our leaders intend to do, then that is a dangerous thing. But what they were really complaining about was, hey, we had access and we don't have access anymore. We like to be treated a certain way and we're not getting treated that way anymore.
Yeah, it was very much, it was an entitlement kind of thing to me. Yeah, it was.
But it's continued. And it's continued even when it doesn't seem like it's part of the same thing. This shit with Trump suddenly being president because he managed not to wet his pants in public for an hour. It's still a different side of that same entitlement. Oh, he talked to us kind of the way we like. Therefore, he's good now.
Yeah, or you know, there's this. On the one hand, it's like, okay, you're entitled to First Amendment rights, right? It's like there is a freedom of the press, yeah. So like this shouldn't happen. But at the same time, it's like your attitude shouldn't be like a 16-year-old who didn't get a nice shiny new BMW for her birthday. That's kind of the attitude that they had, like, well, where's my BMW? Like that was kind of how it came across.
It was promised to me. You told me I was going to get it. Yeah. Sometimes it comes across like that, but the image I get is, it's no more flattering. It's a group at a country club saying things. Well, that's not how we do things here at Watford. And that's what I get from them at the Watford Glen Country Club. That is not how we do things.
And that is something that Trump has really effectively tapped into, and I give him credit for that. Though and all the while actually being in that same fucking country club, that's the thing. Yeah, it's like that's the con of it. Yeah,
I've told you this before. The only reason that I think the free press is going to survive, because I mean, I really think Bannon wants to go through the throat, is that Trump still wants it to be there. He wants better press, and he wants to be able to
because without a press, he can't put on a show. And that's really what he cares about, is putting on a show.
And it's weirdly encouraging to me because, you know, when he was elected, I really thought we were going dark. I thought we're going to see journalists in jail. And we still might. Don't get me wrong. With Jeff Sessions heading the Justice Department, we still might see a reporter or two spend some jail time.
Jeff Sessions will be out. They got Flynn out of there very fast. So, was it the Times or the Post that brought him down? I think it was the Post.
Yeah, and who did the profile of him? It was the New Yorker that did the long profile after. That was awesome. Yeah, yeah. So I guess, I don't know, to wrap this up, print is a contradiction because, in a sense, it's still the most powerful, weirdly. It's where the actual news is generated. Right, is where the actual reporting is done by these relatively anonymous people, not anonymous within their field, but anonymous, not anonymous to say government officials, but anonymous to the rest of us. who ask the right questions, build up the right relationships, work the same beats for long enough to generate the information that we're getting. And then that's what shows up on your feed. And then people arguing about what it means is what consumes your afternoon on Facebook, right? That's but the kernel of truth at the beginning, the actual reporting is done still by the print. And they're dying, yet they're not dead. And so many smaller print offshoots are dead. So many small local papers are dying and are dead. But a lot of that has made the strongest in some ways stronger. It's also made them more isolated. I mean, print's just a... We desperately need the news gathering capabilities and the reporting technique of these organizations. We need them. Like, the United States can't function without them. And yet they are an elitist club that probably could stand reformation. And they and their business model, their previous business model, doesn't work anymore. So it's just very strange. We really need this loose confederation of elites to work for the rest of us, kind of, but not quite for free. And we hope that they can find enough a way to make money for themselves. They can keep doing their public service, which is also a business. It's a weird section of America is the press.
Yeah, the printed press. Here's the interesting thing. So let's get historical here. I was just kind of thinking about, you know, we talked in previous episodes about the rapid consolidation of broadcast media, right? How there are essentially six media conglomerates that just kind of own everything. And newspapers aren't included in that. So there's Viacom, there's actually, I said NBC Universal, even though it was GE, but now it's Comcast that actually owns NBC and Universal Studios. So it's really Comcast.
Billy, what up?
Disney. Yeah, that's right.
They're building a new tower next to their other tower. Like, the Skyline affiliate is...
Wow, nice.
Yeah, the Skyline affiliate is, other than the really cool City Hall, is kind of shitty. It's like pretty small. It's like three streets. It's just not impressive if you've ever been up the road to New York. And so, like, 60% of the Skyline seems to be Comcast buildings at this point. You're like, yeah, there's another giant fucking Comcast car. Anyway, sorry.
So the other ones are Sony, Time Warner, and News Corp. Or I guess it's called 21st Century Fox. They might have retitled it, but it was News Corporation. So yeah, it's those six that basically just own everything in movies and TV. But like, newspapers are not included in that. They had their own consolidation. I mean, obviously there were the newspaper barons back in the day, like William Randolph Hearst, who became the unofficial subject of Citizen Kane. Right? They had like their he had his newspaper chains. I think there were other barons, and it got to this strange point where, as newspapers began to lose money, there was this consolidation. I think slightly before that. So there were these chains of newspapers owned by like the Hearst Company, or the Gannett Company was like another one. But they were all losing money, right? It's like, I think the San Francisco Chronicle was losing like $1 million a week or something like that, which is depressing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I just what do you make of that? Because like, obviously newspapers and the people doing that kind of hard news reporting, extremely important. And it's like the consolidation thing that sort of ushered in the sort of new corporate world for movies and TV. I'm just trying to think, because I mean, I think the New York Times has remained autonomous, but obviously Jeff Bezos of Amazon has actually bought the Washington Post.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wonder
and if to if his credit, a, so far he's let it run.
The tech companies or something might step in and kind of save the day.
Zuckerberg keeps making feints this direction, but everything that he says is just not promising to me.
Jesus. Like, he did that manifesto. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I didn't actually read it. I just read the Atlantic piece on it, and the Atlantic piece on it was not kind. I'm sure you read it.
Yeah, I read the...
Yeah.
Yep, I read the same piece.
I'm sure you read it, because you read The Atlantic like I do.
He's made a few similar broad statements that are... They're low on direct policy, but I think he wants to help, but one, he still needs to make his billions, and two, he's kind of naive about some of
this. He's very naive about how the world actually views Facebook, right? Because like when you hear him actually talk about Facebook, it's like I'm like, what are you describing here? I mean, he genuinely thinks that like Facebook is like destined to be this thing that's like part of the spine of everyone's life, where you know in between all the vertebrae are, you know, all the pictures of your kids and stuff, and like it's just gonna be there forever with Facebook, you know, just collecting all that nice wonderful data about you. And he doesn't really see that as like creepy or weird. And
he's been in it so long that because for him it's personal, I think, right? Like, well, no, he's like, I developed a great service that kind of does everything that fill in the gaps in your life. And for him, it makes sense. He's like, I made this really cool program for myself, and I'm sharing it with you. For the rest of us, it's, you've made this thing that got so popular so fast that it's become almost a necessity in daily life.
And the users don't understand what it is at a fundamental level. Like, when they actually get a glimpse, I mean, I mentioned in the initial media episode about social media, I think I even mentioned like 10 years ago when the news feed debuted, and it was like a shock to everyone's system, because everyone realized like, oh my God, the privacy that for some reason we thought we had is not existing. Like, they're collecting data on this, and then they're like shoveling it back in everyone's faces through the news feed. What's up with that? Like, I thought this was private. And I'm like, well, you're on a website that's able to track your data and all your behaviors and everything. Like what are you expecting?
All the website does is that. That's the other thing that people sound to get. What is Facebook? It watches you act. It watches you do. And it records that. That's it. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, so... And that's kind of what the internet is. I mean, so part of my job is to make my company's website, which is I work for a subdivision of a $1 billion international company. Basically, I help them better collect data on users of its website so it can more efficiently sell to them. And there's like a analytics platform I'm pitching to them is called Crazy Egg, which basically gives you like exact heat map data of exactly how far people scroll down the page, exactly where the cursor on the page goes. So you can see like, okay, they click on this button, but not that button. So therefore you should probably change the text on that button. So it's, you know, might increase the click-through rate or something, or maybe just scrap that section of the site, because people, I guess, don't want that. They're not clicking on it, right? So there's just all these kind of things that is just inherent to the digital experience that you can just track. And with the Facebook, and I mean, one of the points of the Atlantic piece was something I hadn't thought about, which was, and maybe I would have thought about it if I had actually read Zuckerberg's thing, but that Zuckerberg just assumes that these news sources are just going to keep providing news to Facebook. And I don't see why they wouldn't, because they sort of, people are like, websites are just desperate to get shares on Facebook. Like, so the contention that the writer of that piece had, I'm not sure where that was a valid criticism or point. So.
I think if Facebook is this all-encompassing monopolistic marketplace, then you can still expect news organizations to funnel through there. Yeah, I don't think that will necessarily stop them. I guess on the whole, I'm very confused about print journalism, but I'm some kind of optimistic about it. Obviously, literal print journalism will die shortly. There's just no there's no way that's sticking around. Yeah, it's a miracle. I said earlier, I'm surprised the New York Times, like, as a paper edition, still exists. The change has happened so fast in my lifetime, from newspapers being big business and an important part of everyday life, and, like, you know, when I'm 10 years old in 1998, to almost 20 years later, you just won't see that anymore. That just won't happen. Shortly. And it's surprising even that it's still there. But I think the apparatus, the reporting apparatus, that drive to know things, and even this class of people, this cadre that we're talking about, this elite club, I think they'll keep it alive. They'll keep. It's a very, very American thing.
And it's still a popular major with, like, college students.
People want to know stuff.
At least it was when I was college age. Because, I mean, I know, what, like, when I was in high school, like, I wanted to be, like, a sports writer or something. Like, that was kind of, yeah. I was really into sports, and that was kind of something I wanted to do. And then I realized, like, there were so many other people who wanted to do it that I was kind of like, do something else.
Yeah. I think people both want to, people are curious. Americans are extremely curious and kind of dickish about it. Like, we'll ask questions until we get some kind of answer. And there's a lot of laws allowing us to do that more safely than in other places in the world. Yeah, so I don't think it's going away, which is nice, which is good. I feel essentially positive, even though I have no idea exactly what it will look like.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with your assessment that it essentially can't go away, because, I mean, it serves such an important function in terms of, like, there have to be reports of stuff happening, right? Like, that's just like that. It's necessary for our society to function. So where there's demand, I think there's going to be supply. I mean, I think there has to be some, like, if there's an actual need for that in society, I mean, there has to be some kind of way for money to find its way there, to people to get paid to do that.
And I think what's going to happen eventually is, I actually think you'll start seeing, not papers, but I think you'll start seeing local news organizations again. Probably have to be subscription based.
Yeah, it'll probably be
they'll advertise through
probably
Facebook.
Be like blogs or something. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they, to some extent, they have that already in the form of like blogs or something. But yeah,
but I'm thinking you'll see. I think you'll see actual, like, maybe even loosely organized, but I think you'll see actual news organizations where there's some kind of editing. They at least aspire to adhere to the old journalistic rules. I think you'll start seeing that again. You're already seeing things like that. It's just you're seeing a lot of on the front lines. This is where it was like at, you know, the protest or the town hall meeting or whatever. You're seeing from left and the right, but it's not.
Well, to go back to sports, I mean, this is actually interesting that I keep coming back to sports, but the site that I actually look at a lot is, like, the Comcast Sportsnet Mid-Atlantic website, just because there's a lot of, like, Wizards news, and they actually have, like, Wizards reporters and, you know, people who are just on that beat, and I guess they have, like, a couple columnists, and it's like that is kind of you know, obviously a particular niche that would just be the sports section of a newspaper.
Yeah,
but the other thing about sports that I meant to mention earlier when we were talking about the sort of viral marketing that some of these websites do with just hijacking other people's content is, you know, I saw a couple of years ago that the way the sports journalism world used to kind of work was, you know, obviously you wouldn't start out as a columnist right away. You'd start out as a reporter. You'd, like, be assigned a team's beat. But even before you got to do that, you'd have to, like, cover kind of the college or high school sports, or typically you'd have to, like, basically write, you know, game recaps of, like, Division II and III games. And what I saw was that, I think it was, like, the Associated Press was basically cutting out those jobs, and like, nationwide, they were pretty much cutting out those sort of entry level reporting jobs of reporting Division II and Division III games. and just they were basically setting up some kind of like computer algorithm to like just churn out some kind of article and like spin something up based on like they would just like feed in the box scores and names and stuff, and they would just kind of churn it out based
on. Yeah, I've heard about this sort of software a few times now. Yeah.
Yeah, which is that's I think that kind of is an unfortunate part of the future.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's gonna happen. It's funny. I'm usually a total Luddite. I'm terrified of almost every new thing that comes around. But that's one that doesn't scare me too much because that actually is quite perfunctory. Like box scores, recaps, those things are they're not
well.
Or game recaps are not ever. You don't need to have a human write those.
Right.
As someone who's read thousands.
That's how some people get started, though. Like that's the difference between some people maybe starting their career in journalism and going on to doing, you know, something bigger, and maybe having to quit and going to do something else, right? It's just, it shrinks the pool of overall journalists.
Yeah. And so I guess I'd worry more if I thought that sports were as vital.
True. I'm just saying, like, that's an example. They could probably, they'll probably start doing that kind of thing with
other
aspects
news?
Of life. Yeah. Other news. Yeah. I'm sure they'll figure out some kind of way.
I think that would be harder to do. I think there will probably always be value in someone actually being there, because you're not just reporting the events. You're deciding what's important within the events. Within a sport, you can tell pretty clearly this player scored the most. This is kind of how the game went. But you have to describe a little bit more than that. You have to pick apart why something's important. You can't just relay what somebody said. If you're doing a game recap, you're literally just saying this is what they did. If you're going to a Sean Spicer press conference, you're saying this is what he said. This is why it was scary and crazy, even though you can't say that explicitly if you're adhering to journalistic code. You have to explain why it's important that this crazy person said these wild things. So yeah, I'm a little less worried for sports journalism maybe.
Here's the thing. here's the thing. So what will happen is, I mean, this really isn't even new. What'll happen is, so with any given event, here's basically the equivalent of, you know, how I mentioned the Huffington Post got their start by aggregating a huge amount of content, but it was sort of more human driven. But you can basically do the same thing now. You know, if you have some kind of Breitbart-ish sort of bent to the site where the columnist and commentary section of the site is sort of very attention grabbing. And then with the reporting aspect of the site, all you really do is just aggregate other reports, and you basically have like some kind of algorithm, you know, doing that. And it doesn't take any sort of human involvement. That doesn't sound threatening, but problem
that sounds threatening. Yeah, I'll say that's threatening.
That by itself, if that's just one site, doesn't sound threatening to the industry as a whole. But if suddenly, you know, there's a lot of money in that, there's a huge feeding frenzy with like all sorts of other sites like that, basically sucking up all the traffic that would otherwise go to New York Times, Washington Post, stuff like that. There's this constant threat of legitimate. There's this constant threat of like people constantly trying to suck traffic away from legitimate enterprises. It's like it's a fact of the internet, pretty much.
So what you're telling me is that this is the first time. It's probably the first time since November 7th that I've evinced any sort of positivity. Any kind of optimism. And you're telling me, I can't have this.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Oh, well. Well, I guess we'll have to leave it there.
The good news about even in that
about
kind of
everything in the
even
future,
in that kind of situation journals. Where all these zombies from The Walking Dead pretty much go around feasting on, you know,
the corpse
all these news. all these basically dying newspapers. I don't think the New York Times or Washington Post are going anywhere ever. And that
I hope not.
That gives me a lot of hope. They're really strong institutions, and they're important. And even when well-known publications make missteps, like Rolling Stone did with the was that when you were in China, or did that happen before?
No, that was, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, that was a while before. Okay. But yeah, a rape on campus. Yep. They had a rape.
Yeah, and it's like, and so they wrote the story, which is bogus. And then I think they're probably still facing a lawsuit for that. And so they pretty much had to take Peter Travers and David Frick, the editor in chief, off of staff and make them contributors instead, which pay cut, and I'm assuming benefits cut too. That I think, first of all, I think something like that kind of stuff does threaten smaller publications. I don't think the Post or Times would, even if that kind of thing were to happen, I don't think that would have the same effect.
So I'm more bullish, I guess, about the future of journalism as a practice, as an ideal. I don't know that those specific organizations will be there forever, but I am heartened by how strong they have been.
The Economist has been there for like over 150 years, I think. So,
Hey, there's hope.
And the Atlantic, I think, has been there since like the late 1800s.
The Atlantic's a little more commentary than hard reporting most of the time, but I do like the Atlantic for the most part. But. Let's leave it at me being happy about the future. Let me have this nice thing, and we can talk about something miserable next time. There'll be plenty of grist for the mill, because our president is the host of The Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah.
Still.
Well.
Hasn't been impeached yet.
Sessions is going down, man. But, all right. Yeah.
That'll be another one for the Post if that's the case.
Yeah. All right, guys. We'll regroup and come up with something else to talk about for the next episode. And
something else.
See you next time.
I'll see you.
Break! Hey, guys. Eric Mack here again. And thank you for listening to episode number 8. Of Liberally Correct. We do appreciate you listening all the way through and getting to listen to us babble on and on and on. So I forgot to mention the song at the top of this episode. It was Talk Show on Mute by Incubus from their 2004 album, A Crow Left of the Murder, one of my favorite albums. And to close this out, I will go with a song that is also from that album. It was a big hit when I was a sophomore in high school. But seems like it was it's eerily prescient, kind of written with Donald Trump in mind. So this is called Megalomaniac.
that all